This is People First Radio On Demand, podcasts, streaming, and MP3 downloads, available when you want to listen at chly.ca and at the People First Radio website.
CHLY 101.7 FM, Vancouver Island. On the web, www.chly.ca.
The city of Detroit's bankruptcy filing made big headlines, but the city's decline has been underway for decades. The Associated Press observed that Detroit had fallen into a six-decade downward spiral of job losses, shrinking population, and a plummeting tax base. But numerous media outlets are reporting that Detroit is not the only big U.S. city in trouble. Chicago is also facing similar financial problems. In the face of political impotence, looming resource depletion, and catastrophic climate change, many of us have become reconciled to an uncertain future. However, popular perceptions about how this future might actually unfold vary widely. From a severe and prolonged recession to James Howard Kunstler's long emergency to the complete breakdown of civilization. In a book called The Five Stages of Collapse, author Dmitry Orlov introduces a taxonomy of collapse and offers a surprisingly optimistic perspective on surviving the sweeping changes of the day.
I spoke with Dmitry earlier this week in an extensive interview based on the content in his new book, The Five Stages of Collapse. I began by asking him to give a summary of each of the five stages that he has proposed.
The reason I decided to propose a taxonomy of collapse and tease it apart into several stages is because I discovered that most people are trapped in a couple of different modes, one of which is faith in infinite technological progress and economic growth forever, and the opposite, which is the apocalypse and instant horrific collapse of everything, the end of the world as we know it, etc. So either people are trapped in this kind of technocentric narrative that economists and technologists plug away at, or it's suddenly the apocalypse and the stuff of horror films. And in fact, there are different types of faith that we use to hold on to what we consider reality. Faith in financial institutions, faith in the free market, faith in the government and in law and order, faith in our fellow creatures, fellow men. Those are all separate categories. So I looked at each one separately and discovered that they're all very likely to collapse and do at various times, and that collapse is not something unusual. It's what happens throughout human history with great regularity. Financial collapses are almost guaranteed to occur periodically whenever there's a great accumulation of unrepayable debt. And financial collapse tends to run its course within a single day, a single afternoon sometimes, because all it takes is for the faith in the assumptions about the future to be undermined. So, for example, for debts to be repayable, the growth rate must exceed the interest rate over time. And it hasn't really done that for quite a while, so we're accumulating debt at an ever-increasing rate. And we have something called ZIRP now, zero interest rate. That is supposed to be a mechanism to produce economic growth, but it doesn't actually work because it only affects banks. And the Federal Reserve in the United States is, in fact, in the process of losing control over interest rates. Once it does, then all of these debts become unrepayable and bankruptcy looms. Now, commercial collapse is it is based on a different type of faith, which is the faith in the free market that it will provide, that you can actually get whatever it is you need simply by paying for it. And, you know, printed money is just paper. You have to keep that in mind. And at some point, you are likely to hear the strange-sounding words, your money is no good here, where you can't get what you need by paying for it. Now, what is likely to happen to a lot of Western and North American economies is loss of access to imports as their currencies collapse. That is likely to come from disruptions to the global supply chains. you have to keep in mind that the global economy as it exists today is sort of a Humpty Dumpty-like entity that was put together in an era of cheap energy, which is over. We're in an era of expensive energy now. And so the energy that was used to put it together no longer exists. And once it falls apart, it will never come back. Now, political collapse is something that is prevented by basically bread and circuses. As long as the population is fed and entertained, it's unlikely to revolt. But the fiction of representative democracy that we have in all of the developed countries in the world only works when everyone is fed and entertained. The revolutions that we've been seeing around the world are really just food riots of one sort or another. And so it is likely to start happening in more and more countries over time because the food situation is unlikely to continue to improve. Now, the last two categories of collapse are probably the most troublesome ones. Social collapse is the failure of social institutions where people can no longer provide for each other as a society or a group or as a clan. And cultural collapse is really the process by which humanity loses its human qualities and becomes something that is not quite animal but not really recognizable as human. And you can see signs of both social and cultural collapse. There are a lot of patterns of learned helplessness in developed economies where people cannot really provide for themselves. They expect to be taken care of by professionals every step of the way. And once the money to pay those professionals is no longer there, then they're left with absolutely nothing. Cultural collapse, you can also see glimpses of it in the United States, where, you know, the country has the highest divorce rate in the world. The families, a lot of the families are very weak and very, very much estranged. Fully one-third of the children is being brought up fatherless. So these are the sorts of things that you can recognize as certain types of collapse and certain types of faith, people's faith in each other, that has been demolished over time, replaced with various types of impersonal institutions that are unlikely to hold together and last. And this is not something that is easily reversed. You know, you can, once the government fails, you can maybe come up with a different government. But if your society has failed, then you're not likely to come up with a different society, except over a very long period of time.
You specifically address the word efficiency in your chapter on commercial collapse. Tell us more about the concept of efficiency.
Now, the reason efficiency is such an interesting thing to think about is that we're constantly being sold the idea that efficiency is everywhere and in every way a net positive for everyone involved. Now, it turns out that, you know, efficiency is the opposite of resilience. So if you look at efficient systems, they are very highly evolved and very highly refined and organized. They need a certain quantity and quality of inputs without which they don't function at all. They tend to be higher tech and involve the use of specialized labor in order to maintain them. Etc. And what you have to actually ask in each situation is, if something is more efficient than something else, then who is it efficient for? Who benefits from that efficiency? So to give you a concrete example, if you have a cheap old car that you can fix yourself with junkyard parts and tools that are in a box in the back, that may be more efficient for you because that car is then so cheap for you to operate then that you can avoid getting a second job, for instance, or avoid having to work much at all. Whereas, you know, a modern hybrid with lithium batteries that can only be maintained at a service station which has the right sort of computer setup because the whole thing is highly computerized, well, it uses less gas, but it burns more money, and the money that it burns is your money, not somebody else's. So it's very efficient for the engineers who design it and for the people who sell it, but it is less efficient for you. So that is really the way people have to look at efficiency. And keep in mind that efficiency is often the opposite of resilience. Inefficient, low-tech systems tend to be resilient. They continue to operate because they're insensitive to the quality of inputs. They can be maintained much more easily with junkyard parts or something improvised, etc., whereas the highly efficient solutions that are touted by engineers and economists are often boondoggles that can only operate if you keep throwing money at them, only for as long as you keep throwing money at them.
In your chapter on political collapse, you directly address the meanings and concepts associated with anarchy. Tell us about anarchism.
Well, anarchy is very interesting, but not anarchism. Anarchism is, anachronism would be another word for it. It's a political movement that never was, I suppose. But anarchy is simply lack of hierarchy. And, we have different types of hierarchy around, patriarchy, matriarchy, institutions that have a reporting structure or a chain of command. These are unique to the human species. Animals don't have any kind of stiff hierarchical organization to them. They tend to be anarchically organized. Throughout most of human history, we have been organized in small groups that were anarchic. We didn't have anything like representative democracy until very, very recently. And it's sort of an aberration in human history. We're not really evolved to have structures like that. So anarchy is very interesting to look at because, remaining anarchic avoids a great number of pitfalls that humanity tends to become entrapped in. Small groups work best when organized anarchically, self-organized, self-governing. Large groups have to resort to authoritarian measures of one sort or another. Dictatorship of the law is one type of dictatorship. You don't have to have a physical dictator. You can have a shelf full of law books to tell you exactly what to do. And it's only possible to maintain these very complex, hierarchically organized systems when there's a lot of cheap or free energy and other resources available. And once those resources become scarce, then we have to basically go back to living in small groups of around 150 people, small tribes or clans. And these clans don't have the capacity to squander resources on hierarchical organization. So anarchy is the only way for them to exist. And this is why anarchy deserves a second look, not as a political movement, but as an organizing principle. I think there are few things that are more pleasant than a well-organized anarchy.
Small states are seen as much better for their citizens than large states. Why?
Now, the reason small states can be more democratic is because each person has a greater share of personal sovereignty. So an Icelander is a sovereign giant, and a Chinese citizen is a sovereign dwarf. Your voice is diluted by the size of the population. And citizens of populous states are, by definition, politically speaking, midgets. The only way they can make their voice heard is by voting for somebody who speaks largely for themselves, because the moment you have representation, political representation, you end up with a political class with its own set of interests. And the set of interests of the people in politics is quite distinguishable from the set of interests of those who are supposed to vote for them.
You write that the only real capital is social capital, and that the amount of pre-collapse social capital determines a level of post-collapse consolidation and cooperation that can be achieved. Tell us more about the concept of social capital.
Well, social capital is the only thing that really remains after the various stages of collapse run their course. Ultimately, all impersonal systems fail. They fall apart. And all that is left is personal sympathy and trust. And these are very difficult to generate. They take a long time. A lot of the time, they only exist between people who are related to each other, either through birth or marriage, and have lived together for extended periods of time. And it also it is also very easy to destroy. It can be destroyed very quickly in one day.
You share what was, for me, a startling example of the way the economy, commerce, and society work at the present moment on page 183, and I'm just going to quote from that chapter. In a recent scandal, the Target chain committed the faux pas of offering discounts on baby products to women who did not yet know they were pregnant. And this was all based on their recent purchases of things like unscented face cream, larger size bras, and various soft plush items. Tell us more about this phenomenon.
Well, targeted marketing and big data is very popular these days, is another attempt to automate society. You know, we spend more and more of our time in developed countries talking to robots just to get anything at all done. Either we talk to some kind of a web app, which is a robot, or we talk to a phone maze, which is another type of robot. This is all the result of one single trend or you know, one aspect of technology, which is that it's very hard to program computers. You have to be a specialist. You have to have specialized skills. It takes years to get all the bugs out of a complicated system, and they're expensive to operate and run, etc. So there are limits to how intelligent you want to make computers, but then it turns out that it's much easier to program people to behave like machines. And so that has been really the trend for a long time. And I think the major breakthrough in that category is all the mobile computing devices, the smartphones and the tablets, etc. Because now everybody is pretty much a Borg, you know, you like from Star Trek, you know, they have these Borg characters that are half machine. Well, I mean, you know, in any city you can take a train, you know, commuter rail or a bus and watch these people who are plugged into their little electronic devices. They can't exist aside from them. And so you get to filter their reality through a little electronic device and determine what it is they perceive as reality and then control them. So this is like a parasite taking over the mind of a snail for it to be eaten by a bird. You know, there things like that exist in nature. Well, this is similar to that. Here you have a parasite taking over a human brain to make them go and shop and buy certain things.
In your chapter on social collapse, you write, as everyone becomes progressively poorer, the people in rich countries have much more to learn from the rest of the world than the other way around. Tell us more about that.
Well, people in rich countries have lots of unreasonable expectations. They expect toilets to flush. They expect lights to go on when they flip a light switch. When something fails, they expect to be able to call up some specialist who will rush over and fix it. And people in poor countries don't have such unreasonable expectations. They don't expect things to work correctly or at all. And so they're much more capable of shifting for themselves, of taking care of their own and of muddling through no matter what happens. You know, they don't sit there and wait to be rescued because they know that there's nobody to rescue them.
You write that the most important element of preparing for collapse is to devise a plan to force through a swift and thorough change of the rules by which society operates. What do you mean by that?
Immigrant communities have much better coping mechanisms of various sorts. First of all, a lot of them still have functional extended families, and they prioritize their families above the rest of society, which the rest of society doesn't really do very well. And you know, they don't have strange ideas like the idea that the police is there to protect you rather than to rob you, which tends to be the case throughout the world. The police are there to fend for their own kind. And so these communities can provide, if you will, a cultural seed stock for the reestablishment of human scale community, that where people actually base everything on personal relationships as opposed to commercial or political or financial impersonal arrangements that are enforced through the threat of violence, through the court system or through the police, because those things are the most fragile.
You write that the stages of collapse occur roughly in the order of financial, commercial, and then political collapse. But you also say that once these three stages have run their course, that everyone's energy should be redirected toward preserving as much of society and culture as they can. Tell us more about that preservation and what it looks like.
Well, the old rules and the new rules, basically the old rules of a developed first world economy become sort of unreasonable requirements, unachievable mandates as things collapse. So take the example of food preparation. It's illegal to provide the public with food unless you have refrigeration, you have running water, you have electric lighting. You basically, the inspector will come and shut you down. So what do you do if you don't have running water and if you don't have electricity? Do you starve? Or do you evacuate? What if there is nowhere to evacuate to? People have to come up with improvised arrangements for providing the necessities, which is like things like food, like shelter, medicine, transportation. To give you a concrete example, it's illegal to transport people in the bed of a pickup truck standing. Even if you're just driving, 15 miles an hour, you can be arrested for doing that. But what if that's the only way you can afford to transport people? People do that all the time in Mexico. It's not like they're dying in droves from doing it. Things like that. There are a lot of regulations that basically have to be thrown out pretty much at the first sign of emergency in order to avoid the emergency from getting continuously worse and eventually becoming lethal for much of the people involved.
Does Detroit's recent attempt to file for bankruptcy and the years leading up to it provide a useful illustration of collapse?
Well, the thing to keep in mind about Detroit is that its suburbs will face the same predicament as the downtown. It's just a time lag. There's nothing that says that the suburbs are any more sustainable than the downtown. Actually, it's the exact opposite. What caused the downtown to crater was white flight and all kinds of social and economic dislocation that was specific to a lot of American towns. That has condemned Detroit and quite a few other places in the U.S., but cities with a viable center will hold together better. So a lot of Canadian cities are much better off than a lot of the cities in the U.S. Places like Boston, like Vancouver, et cetera, stand much more of a chance. But they too will have problems of scale and of maintenance of structures at a huge scale, which structures that have been built up during the heyday of industrial civilization, and then as it dwindles because of high prices for all kinds of resources, including energy, these maintenance requirements will drain them, and they will run into financial trouble of all sorts. First cost, then availability, so. I think what stands a better chance is smaller towns that especially ones that can grow a lot of their own food, and especially the ones that are on the water, because water transportation is so much more energy efficient than road transportation. But big towns everywhere, and especially in the U.S., will probably be not very promising moving forward.
Personal experiences have guided your theories and observations, including time that you spent in Russia. You observed the fall of the Soviet Union. How do you view what is happening now, and how have your views influenced your current lifestyle and living arrangements?
Well, my personal take on collapse is that, once you see the level of suffering that people experience, that the level of loss and despair that comes with it, and how people behave when they lose their dreams, or they lose their sense of self, even you really want to do something about it. So it's not really about me, it's sort of what I can do to help people prepare psychologically. I think psychological preparation is really important. But in terms of practical preparation, the timing and extent of collapse in any given place is rather unpredictable. So you can say with dead certainty that it's going to happen, eventually, but you can't really predict the timing very well. Nobody has ever been able to. And the best you can do is keep your options open, understanding what's happening around you, and not being able to flee, not being able to relocate, being stuck somewhere, is likely to cause a great deal of stress, and stress is a killer. So, if you want to remain relaxed, you should have some options and make sure that you maintain those options open over a period of time.
Dmitry Orlov, thank you very much for taking the time to join us. It was much appreciated.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me on your program. And if you want to follow what I do, it's all on my blog, which is Club Orlov, ClubOrlov. .com, and also my book is available from Amazon and other places, and it's The Five Stages of Collapse.
Dmitry Orlov is an engineer and a writer on subjects related to potential economic, ecological, and political decline and collapse. His latest book, The Five Stages of Collapse, was published by Gabriola Island-based New Society Publishers. You can find Dmitry Orlov online at his immensely popular blog, ClubOrlov.com.
This is a People First Radio podcast. People First Radio is an initiative of Colombian Center Society in partnership with Radio Malasapina Society and produced at CHLY Community Radio in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed in this interview do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the partnering organizations. Visit us online. Just Google People First Radio to find our webpage.